The Guardian.
Welcome back to Film Weekly with me, Jason Solomons. On the show this week, I meet director John McDonagh to find out the inner workings of An Gardaí. That's the Irish police, of course, in his comic crime caper, The Guard. And medicine and morality form the heart of Suzanne Beer's Oscar-winning film In a Better World. I talk to the Danish director about her taut global drama and why Danish film is on a high. Alongside that, I'll be giving you the heads up on some of the week's other releases, including Daniel Craig and Harrison Ford in the genre-bending Cowboys and Aliens. Yes, it's a Han Solo version of your favourite film podcast. It's Film Weekly. The Guard tells of an international drug smuggling investigation off the west coast of Ireland, bringing together the unlikely pairing of Brendan Gleeson as the seemingly racist, bumbling Irish cop Jerry Boyle, together with FBI agent Wendell Everett, played by Don Cheadle.
Now, the men we believe to be involved in the trafficking are Francis Sheehy Skeffington, out of Dublin, Liam O'Leary, also out of Dublin, Clive Cornell, out of London, and James McCormick, out of Limerick. Now, these men are highly dangerous. And if you do make a... Yes, Sergeant.
I thought only black lads were drug dealers.
I'm sorry, what?
I thought only black lads were drug dealers and Mexicans. What did I call them? Do I have a word for them?
Yeah, there's a word for you too, sir. But I'm not going to go into that right now. Anyway, as I was saying, these men are highly dangerous.
And if drug mules. That's enough of your guff now, Boyle. Apologize to the man.
Huh? Apologize for what?
You know for what?
For your racist slurs, for one thing.
I'm Irish, sir. Racism is part of my culture.
The Guard is the debut of London Irish director John Michael McDonagh, who to date has just one other writing credit to his name, the ill-fated Ned Kelly from 2003. But writing success is in the blood. John's brother Martin McDonagh made In Bruges and wrote The Lieutenant of Innisfree. And with John firmly in control of his material as writer and director, this unlikely-looking caper comes alive with wit and deadpan warmth. So I was thrilled to meet up with John McDonagh in London to learn more about the making of The Guard, and I began by stoking up a little bit of sibling rivalry. John McDonagh, I've just been handed this on my way in. It says, The Guard is into its sixth week of release. It's the second biggest film now in Ireland of all time, having overtaken In Bruges. Now, normally this is of course a celebration. In Bruges, a very fine film. But for you, this must mean something a little bit special.
Yeah, it does. When we heard that, I actually got on the phone immediately to Martin, my brother, who the director of In Bruges, and told him, and he just told me to get lost. I think he put the phone down. And then he beat me at tennis the following day. I think he crushed me, so he took his aggression out on that. No, it was very satisfying to beat In Bruges. Now we're chasing Ken Loach, Wind That Shakes the Barley. You know, Ken has had about 30 goes at it, hasn't he? I've only had one, so I think I've done quite well.
Because, I mean, In Bruges, not only is it there's a double McDonagh involved, but there's obviously Brendan Gleeson kind of out-Brendaning himself, and you can't... I mean, your film, you know, has a beautiful script that kind of zings and spits, but Brendan Gleeson is superb. I mean, was he always your man when you wrote it, when you thought about it? Was he in your head when you were even writing the script? Was it for him?
Not when I wrote it, because, you know, I've written scripts before. You write a script for somebody, and if you send it to them and they don't want to do it, you're off to a really bad start. It creates a bad vibe around the project. But once I'd reread it, it's very hard to see who else was going to play that role. Brendan brings a sort of warmth and empathy to that character. I mean, the character's a pretty confrontational character. And if you went with a younger actor, you know, a lot of the humour he comes out with, you know, a lot of the dark humour, it could come across as just being played nasty. Yeah. I think when it's played by Brendan, you know, it's a character who's at the end of his tether, really, and is prepared to say, I'll do anything, because he's sort of given up on life. And I think Brendan brings that sort of empathy to the role, where he plays the comedy, but he plays the tragedy as well. Mm-hmm. So people go along with him, where they might not with a younger man playing that part, you know. And obviously, I didn't really know Brendan that well. We'd met only, I think, In Bruges premiered at Sundance, so we got quite drunk that night, so I knew him from that. And then Martin got the script to him. That's how Martin gets an executive producer credit. That's how you get those credits. So he got Brendan to read it quite quickly, and then he read it quickly. And then once Don knew, it had already been sent to Don Cheadle, and once Don knew Brendan was attached, he read it quickly then. So we had the two leads within the space of a week. So from years of struggling in the British film industry, trying to get films made, you know, I had written a script at Christmas. I think they read it in March. We were shooting in October, in pre-production in September. So incredibly fast.
I was going to ask you, I mean, you know, people say, oh, there's a debut film and here he is. And I mean, but you're no offence here, you're not a young man. And I've known you for quite some time. And yeah. it's been a long time coming. But is it all of a sudden you're ready to write a script that is shootable, that is doable, that is going to attract talents like Don Cheadle and Brendan Gleeson? And then it comes... Does it all click into place if you've done your homework and you've put the work in?
Yeah, I mean, you're one of the few people who's brought up my age, because I thought I'd get hammered for that more often, because I'm 44, which is quite old for a first-time director. Well, what happened was I had a terrible experience on Ned Kelly. So I thought, well, listen, if that's the type of director who's making movies, I can do it myself. So I started writing scripts specifically that were lowish budget and that maybe people will give me the money. And yeah, I'd storyboarded everything. I was prepared. Obviously, you're preparing that for years. And so, you know, wherever your nerves are, you just try to detach yourself from it, walk onto the set and be calm. You know, Brendan and Don said that's the main thing. I think working with directors is somebody who's the person who's at the helm is calm, is a really a positive, incredible thing, because it just filters down to everyone else on the crew. That, you know, they've worked with people before who aren't calm, and it just creates a nasty atmosphere. I think being the writer helps, because if the actor has a question, you're there, you know, and you, because the directors don't often have their writers on the set, as I found out to my cost. So you always have the answer, or if you don't have the answer, you just be honest and say, I actually don't know, let's talk about it, or whatever. And you know, all the actors we had, you know, Brendan and Don, Mark Strong, Liam Cunningham, Fionnuala Flanagan, David Wilmot, they're all sort of really great character actors who are getting sort of leading roles now and stuff like that. And so they've come out of that sort of professional work ethic where they don't really abide all that kind of diva-like behaviour anyway. So it was a group of sort of like-minded individuals. I think casting is so incredibly important. I think on a film, you've often won or lost the film when you cast it. You might as well not turn up sometimes. I mean, we all read where films are coming out and we see what the cast are and we think that's going to be terrible. Yeah. And it always is. So if you get the cast right, yeah, I think you're 70 or 80% there. John Huston used to say that, didn't he? I mean, I think it's people should take more care with. It's not just getting the best actor, it's getting the actor who you think will get along with all the other actors as well. You know, it's really important, that kind of camaraderie.
You can tell you're a first-time filmmaker. You're the only one that actually take... normally, I kind of give the microphone to them. And you take it and you own it. I like what you're doing there. You're making it your own, John. It's very exciting. What must have been exciting for you is that the script... I mean, whilst you were on set and you could have tinkered with it and played with it, but it's pretty much kind of as you had it in your head. Yeah. They didn't muck around with it too much.
No, I mean, no actor's going to come up with better lines than I can come up with. The other thing, I like to keep a lid on that, because when an actor has, even if they have one ad lib, right, they walk away thinking they've co-written the script. That's the way an actor's mind works. No, Brendan and Don, you know, Brendan would have a little gag every now and again. He had, you know, the end of there's a milkshake sequence. He has a funny line at the end. That was an ad lib. And Don, you know, obviously I'm not American, so I'd let Don not totally rework the lines, but get it into the idiom of American. So I'd let him play around with it in that way. Mostly it was all there. I mean, the script was good enough. You didn't really need to, you know, screw around with it.
Yeah. It's one of those scripts that, I suppose, like in Bruges, there's like a sort of a rash of later Irish comedies, and the one that sort of kickstarted it for me was Paddy Brennan's I Went Down, which stars your man Brendan.
Yeah.
And since then, we've had a sort of...
Run of really bad films.
No, not bad. You get a run of, I suppose, loquacious Irish ruffians. You know what I mean? Yeah. The poetry is within the violence of the soul. Perry is Bounty. I think they all can tend to star Brendan Gleeson in some kind of way.
No, well.
But is there something in the Irish soul that you're allowed to write kind of ruffians who've also got a bit of the, you know, the Blarney in them?
Well, Perrier's Bounty, I mean, I probably shouldn't say this, but I'd sent an email to Brendan saying it represents everything I despise about the Irish film industry. It's there are a lot of those films are made, yes, by people who don't have any sort of cinematic sensibility whatsoever. And they don't seem to prepare. And you get the feeling when you watch a lot of these films, have they ever seen an Antonioni movie? You know, have they ever seen a Godard movie? I don't think they have. Not that you have to be that pretentious about it, but there should be some sort of overriding scheme, you know, or theory when you go into making a film. I Went Down is a good, I mean, that's a good one. That and a film called Garage, my two favourite Irish movies. there's not a lot else. It's pretty much a wasteland. So, you know, I thought, you know, if that's all the competition, I could, we can compete with this film. Yeah, I mean, obviously, Brendan's great and I went down Peter MacDonald. That was where a lot of Irish films, the quirkiness overtakes the narrative. I think that's a problem. And they don't seem to take as much care with the visual aspects of the film or the production design. I mean, whether you like The Guard or not, it has got a specific production design with bright colours. There's a big colour palette in the film. And that was a specific thing that Larry Smith and I and John Paul Kelly, the production designer, and Ema, the costume designer, wanted to do. We didn't want a low-budget, miserablest British-Irish movie that we used to see, you know, working class characters in kitchens frying bacon and shouting at each other. I didn't want to do that.
But you got a bit of that, but then you've got the big hotels. I mean, in a sense, I mean, the two things that I really need to ask you, that anyone listening to you can say, maybe you might sound a bit Irish, London Irish. What's the Irish in you that gives you the right to kind of write these wonderful lines for Irish people and be part of the Irish film industry? Because frankly, you don't sound very Irish to
me. No, I'm from South London. I get a nosebleed if I cross Waterloo Bridge, basically. But my family, my mother's from Sligo, my dad's from Galway, so we would, myself and Martin, would go over for summer holidays all the time we were growing up. And we still go back now 3 or 4 times a year. My parents live in a place called Spiddle in Galway, which John Ford's parents are from. I thought that hopefully there'd be some kind of filmmaking genius osmosis that would filter down to me in Spiddle. So we go back quite a lot. I find the South London sort of character, the sort of abrasive, sarcastic, deadpan sense of humour, is quite similar to Connemara people. They have that sort of, don't be coming here over here with your big ideas, we're going to cut you down to size sort of thing. So I never had a problem, you know, writing in that kind of idiom, really. I kind of felt the rhythms. I guess you just pick it up as you, because you're there so often, it just became sort of second nature to me, really. I mean I'm an outsider, I guess, I'm an outsider in England because my parents were from Ireland, so you're detached from England, but I'm also detached from Ireland. Maybe that helps when you're, you know, when you're writing these kinds of scripts, it's a kind of slightly skewed voice.
And so the idioms that are in your head, the accents, the kind of jokes, are they people that you knew when you were growing up, when you were visiting them, are they your relatives, your mum and dad themselves even?
There are those sorts of characters who just, you know, somebody's really happy and joyous about something and somebody comes in with some witty, biting remark that really creates a bad atmosphere. So that was quite common. No, I'd say it was more the character Jerry Ball comes more out of me being like really sort of bitter and contemptuous with the UK film industry. So that's where it all came from.
Finally, I got to ask, it seems to me that there's something about the Irish wit and humour, especially in your film about people getting rich and there's some money and there's obviously a bit of poverty going on, but there's a bit of wealth as well. Ireland in the last 10 years, we mentioned I went down, we go back to that time, it just started to become a tiger economy, and all that time Dublin's taken off and it's huge now, and now of course it's crashing down where you, is there, I think there's a sense of that in your film. There's a kind of hope and despair kind of path that goes on there.
Yeah, there is. I didn't want to sort of make it a messagey film. I might try to push that a bit further in the next one myself and Brendan want to make, called Calvary, which is about a good priest who's tormented by his community. And we want to get a few more of those sorts of ideas in. I mean, in the Guard, there are a lot of jibes at Dublin and Dublin people. Dublin people are riding the crest of a wave for the last 10 years, you know, and now it's all come down, you know. These are people who are in charge of, you know, the banking systems, the cultural system, you know, the TV all comes out of Dublin. And where did it get us? It got us nowhere, you know. We're in the middle of a recession. They were responsible for destroying Ireland, really. So, yeah, all those jibes, I'm going to see if I can take it a bit further in the next one, get back at them even more.
Well, for now, we'll content ourselves with The Guard, which is both hilarious, funny, but also poignant as well. It doesn't say that on the poster.
No, it doesn't say melancholy. No. They don't like to put melancholy on a film poster.
It's a long word, but it is melancholy. And we'll talk to you about it. I don't want to give away an ending, but I reckon there must be, I don't know, the script you say, was it, how many endings did you have in that script? How many did you play with?
It was always meant, I cut a scene which made the ending more positive, let's say. You knew what the resolution would definitely be, but I cut it because I definitely wanted an ambiguous ending. And that goes into, we use John Denver's leaving on a jet plane at the end, which, you know, my bags are packed, I'm ready to go, which is kind of a hopeful sort of guy's escape. But John Denver died in a plane crash. So even the song is ambiguous.
Yeah. You know what? I missed that little symbolism. I like it. John McDonough, congratulations on overtaking your brother, because he's a right little bollock.
Yes, he is. He deserves everything he gets.
Congratulations on the car, mate. Gora Ma Agut to John Michael McDonough there, as my producer tells me to say it. The Guard goes on UK-wide release from this Friday, the 19th of August. And now for some of this week's other releases.
Palms to heaven, friend.
Easy now.
All right. Turn around, nice and slow.
I've been shot.
Only two kinds of men get shot. Criminals and victims. Well, which one are you?
I don't know.
You got a name, friend?
I don't know that either.
Well, just what do you know?
English.
This week's blockbuster, Cowboys and Aliens, can at least, like a grizzled gunslinger, look you squarely in the eye and say, what you see is what you get. It's cowboys taking on aliens in an Arizona town in 1873, with sheriffs, strangers, outlaws, Indians, and a deputy related to John Wayne, all forming a posse to fend off alien hordes who, like everyone, are mining for gold. Can Harrison Ford and Daniel Craig lend this one-gag concept any heft? Will Jon Favreau bring wit to the direction? Well, it's fun as far as it goes. In the Bond meets Indy stakes, Daniel Craig is rather good with a gun twirl and a Stetson. Harrison, though, is looking a bit tired. I half expected him to deliver a trademark to camera look and say, I'm getting too old for this shit. But the film never actually gets funny, instead plays it straight, which is a weird way to go with green aliens leaping about a big spaceship in the desert. As it is, we're never sure who's good or bad or why we should want these humans to prevail. Favreau could work that cheeky genre shtick on Iron Man with Robert Downey Jr. in the lead, but Daniel Craig's no quickfire comedian, and the film ends a victim of its own pastiche. Where's Mel Brooks when you really need him?
I've got a dream, and this is mine.
Glee totally celebrates the underdog, and it empowers the underdog in everybody.
Get your booty down here so we can bring this house down!
Glee, the 3D concert movie, is finally here! Hooray! Shout some. I'm sorry, what on earth are you talking about? Say others. As this film appears to be all about cliques, I'm in the latter one. I've never seen Glee on the telly, but I bravely went forth to the cinema to see if I could finally catch up with it. Alas, no. All I got was a bunch of amateurs screeching and hoofing about like some X Factor finalists in a New Jersey shopping mall. Mums and dads seemed happy enough with their children singing along to various decent pop songs being murdered on stage. Jesse's Girl, Valerie, I can hear Amy turning in a grave already, Slave for You, and oh my god, Michael Jackson's PYT. These were sung by people called Blaine and Kurt and Brittany and Rachel, who also appeared to do bad Barbara Streisand impressions. And then Gwyneth Paltrow walked on in a short skirt, still not sexy. What's she doing here? Oh, she's singing CeeLo Green, of course. The concert footage in piss-poor 3D is dull and there are barely even costumes. When I used to go and see the Kids from Fame in concert, at least they wrote their own stuff and put on some outfits. All I could see was a bunch of so-so professional performers pretending to be amateurs, doing glorified karaoke in an all-encompassing wonderland slung between self-empowerment and chronic self-indulgence.
We've been away the whole weekend.
I had to go.
Where?
See Mrs. Descoigne, the widow of that cousin of mine was killed.
All your cousins seem to get killed. I really wouldn't
be in
the least surprised if you murdered them all.
On the other hand, the reissued Kind Hearts and Coronets is a masterpiece of British cinema that maintains its acid wit and dark, almost gothic soul, even today, 62 years after its first release in 1949. It is, of course, famous for Alec Guinness taking 8 roles as every member of the Dascoigne family, including the suffragette Lady Agatha. But it would be wrong to overlook Dennis Price's consummate lead role as Louis Manzini, a studying cold ambition, social climbing, and revenge. Neither performance, however, would endure were it not for Robert Hamer's note-perfect script and direction, which zings like the best of Oscar Wilde and Billy Wilder. It's like the bastard son of The Importance of Being Earnest and Double Indemnity, with Joan Greenwood as Shirley Clapham's most dangerous ever femme fatale. This digital restoration should be celebrated, for a national treasure has truly been preserved, and every schoolchild should see it on the big screen this summer. Although a U certificate seems rather lenient to me, given the murderous sentiments at its cruel heart. And for a full list of reviews and the best film news site on the web, go to guardian.co.uk/film. The current holder of the Oscar for foreign language film, Danish drama In a Better World, also has the distinction of being the first winner in that category to have been directed by a woman, Susanne Bier. It's a melodrama split between a bucolic village in Denmark and a violent refugee camp in Sudan, where Danish surgeon Anton, Michael Persbrandt, is part of a Red Cross-type team. Back home, his attractive wife, Trini Dyrholm, is having difficulties with their older son, Elias, who's being bullied at school. But a new arrival, called Christian, however, shows him a new way of standing up for himself.
Elias, han har lige fortalt os, at du havde en kniv.
Jeg havde ikke nogen kniv.
Okay. Jamen altså, hvis alle sammen lyver, så må du fortælle mig sandheden.
Han slog mig. Og så slog jeg ham.
Men du slår ham med en cykelpumpe.
Jeg blev nødt til det.
And I'm delighted to be joined on the line from Copenhagen by Susanne Bier. Now, congratulations on In a Better World, Susanne. Congratulations on your Golden Globe and on your Oscar as well. An Oscar winner here on the show. Fantastic.
Yeah, it is amazing.
Where is your Oscar? Is it right there? Are you stroking it as you're talking to me?
Not just as I'm talking to you, but I'm doing it frequently.
Yeah, is it inspiring? Because some people I talk to, one of them sort of said, "God, you know, the weight of it is too much. It's like you can't write your next script because it's there staring at you." But you've obviously been right, because not only have you got your Oscar in front of you, you've actually just finished making another film, so it's obviously worked for you.
Well, the movie that I finished was sort of planned before I got nominated, and then I had this moment of thinking, "Is this the right movie? Should I be doing a different kind of movie? Should I kind of think in terms of career?" And then I decided I'm just going to go ahead and do the movie that I was planning to do. Nothing is bulletproof, and you know, you might fail, but that's the way it is. I kind of just decided that it was more fun making movies rather than thinking about career. So
yeah, well, I mean, you must be right, because I mean, In a Better World, for all of its merits, you probably, when you were beginning making that, you never thought that would be the film that was going to win you or Denmark the Oscar.
Exactly. And anyway, I think once you start planning with those things, you're doomed to fail, because you know, directing is pretty much about being sincere, and you can't work and think about things and the storyline and the character. I can't do that.
No,
I have to make a movie for the right reason.
Yeah, I think you have to be in Hollywood to kind of really, really be part of that machine, which may be happening to you one day soon, I'm sure. But let's talk about In a Better World, because that's why we're here. Because it is split between Denmark and a refugee camp in the Sudan. What made you want to tell a story with two parts?
It was more, firstly, because I kind of felt that, or we felt that the story had to have different facets, and actually we've been doing a few movies which are taking place in different places, but also I guess there's also in our part of the world, I feel that we're so privileged, and we, like Northern Europe, is so sort of secluded from what else is going on. So I kind of felt that it was really important to kind of integrate, to kind of feel that actually Africa, actually the third world, is really part of our own world.
Presumably that the African events are supposed to mirror and also illustrate what's going on in this tiny, beautiful village in Denmark. Who would have thought that the two kind of rivers can cross, if you like, the currents can mix?
Yeah, I mean, it was also really important that we saw Denmark from a very beautiful point of view, like from, I really wanted to be idyllic, and I really wanted like the nature and the Danish landscape to actually almost like be a player in the film, and I felt that came out in the way I really wanted it to, because there's been like a number of movies the last 10 years which has to do with the sort of the more rough, less picturesque part of Denmark. And I kind of felt, in order to tell the story, in order to actually really demonstrate how frightening this society can be as well. It had to be beautiful.
Yeah, it is, and it's absolutely beautiful. And people watching it will think, wow, I want to go there on holiday. Where is it?
This is on Fune, and on a small island just south of Fune. But it is, I mean, in real life, you kind of, you know, I want to walk around every day kind of thinking, I want to stay here. It's just so beautiful.
I'm sure you've probably bought a holiday home up there thinking, well, it's good.
I can't afford that.
Oh, really? You need to make some more movies, Suzanne.
I need to win some more Oscars.
Yeah, exactly. Now, what about the African bit? Did you actually film in the Sudan? Where did you go for that?
We filmed in Kenya, and we did film in a kind of refugee camp, actually a displaced people's camp, which is not, they're not refugees from atrocities, but they're refugees because probably they've had like small farms or places, and because of climate, they don't have money to make it running. So it is a camp, but it's not like one of the real severe camps. And then we enlarged it and built a medical facility. We built it, but like the people living in the camp were working as extras in the film, and they were just lovely, and it was amazing. Yeah. It was amazing filming there.
When one's watching the film, the audience is kind of struck between the contrast between Northern Europe and then Africa. But you, as a filmmaker, was that something that you carried with you as well? Were you kind of conscious of the different world that you were entering?
Well, the thing is that the standard of living couldn't be more different. And in general, the conditions of living couldn't be more different. But in a way, the movie also very much talks about human nature being much more the same than being different. So it's very much showing that, yes, we live in completely different ways, but our who we are as human beings, the way we think is much more similar than different.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm wondering what it is that Denmark suddenly seems to be everywhere. Next week we have a film by Lone Scherfig coming out here called One Day here in the UK. It, 10 years ago, you mentioned those kind of gritty Danish films. You were all kind of doing it in natural light and, you know, doing what Lars told you with the Dogma movement. And now here you are, kind of flourishing, doing all sorts of tricks.
Well, I think as a generation of filmmakers, because we at an early stage were forced to concentrate on storytelling and not have all the pleasures of movie making. Like all the Dogma films are gritty because they are only character and storyline. But because we focused on storytelling, we actually became pretty good at that. And then you can add the sort of, all the beauty of real filmmaking. And then, if you are lucky, something good comes out of the cocktail.
Yeah. Now, you won the Oscar. We were talking about you. I did a talk at the Bird's Eye View Film Festival here in London, which showed your film because you're a woman filmmaker, in case people hadn't recognised that. So not only have you won, are you winning an Oscar, but you're also a woman director who's winning an Oscar, which is actually very common these days, I hear. But we were talking...
very uncommon.
But we were talking about you in Cannes as well, because your friend who we mentioned there, Lars von Trier, mentioned you in, I suppose, perhaps the most famous press conference in Cannes history. Have you spoken to him since then? He mentioned you, not very flatteringly, I hasten to add. So I don't know if you two have kind of spoken and made up, or if he was joking. Where are you on the Lars von Trier mystery?
I mean, honestly, I think that whole thing is just really boring. I mean, I haven't spoken to him, and I'm not particularly interested in talking to him. And if he, wants to provoke the world, that's entirely his own responsibility.
Now, you mentioned that you've made another film straight after, while you were winning your Oscar, I suppose you were working on this film, you've just finished making it. Can you tell us what that is? Is it with Pierce Brosnan, am I right?
It is with Pierce Brosnan, yeah. It's a romantic comedy. It's a kind of slightly unlikely romantic comedy where the romantic couple is not the usual kind. I'm just in the early stages of editing, so whatever you ask me, I just won't be able to answer, because at this point it's always more frightening than anything else.
Yeah, but, you don't quite know what it is yet. Tell me, Pierce Brosnan.
But he was great.
Is he speaking Danish in it?
A tiny, tiny bit. he's got a good way with language, so he did actually learn a bit of Danish. But also he was fun, and it was wonderful making the film. So So I hope that that's going to show on the screen as well.
Yeah, well, I'm sure it will. You mentioned winning Oscars and that you were going to do this film anyway before you got your Oscar. But has your world changed for perhaps be in a slightly better world after winning your Oscar? Has it made a difference to you? Have you had offers? Are you doing Batman, the fifth Batman next or something?
No, I'm not doing this with Batman. That's a bit unfair. No, actually, honestly, yes and no. It has changed. I mean, firstly, the accolade is wonderful, and winning the Oscar is just, I think, for any director. You know, I think we've all kind of been standing in the shower thinking about the speech when we were, like, very young. And so it's like, of course, it's a dream come true, and it has generated different kind of offers. It has also, I also decided that, you know, you have to stick true to yourself, and you have to stick true to what you believe in. And until now, that's what I've done. So for me, it's just been a great experience.
Well, absolutely. Congratulations. And thank you very much for coming on Film Weekly. Suzanne Beer, congratulations again.
Thank you very much.
A huge talk to Suzanne Beer, and In a Better World is on general release here in the UK from Friday, the 19th of August. And that's all for this week. The music featured on this week's podcast is by Japanese composer Joe Hisaishi. His melancholic score to the Japanese film Villain, also out this week. Joe's best known for his work on the animations Spirited Away and Ponyo, as well as beautiful scores for Takeshi Kitano's films like Hanabi and Ikujiru. Don't forget, for my trailer trash column and more great film reviews and news, pick up a copy of this Sunday's Observer. However, for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.